It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Emissions from the Clark and Coke Works were in the news last summer and fall, and then again after a December 24th fire. How is the Allegheny County Health Department trying to deal with air quality issues? And what have officials learned from mandatory lead testing for young children? Dr. Karen Hacker is the director of the County Health Department. Welcome back to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
The health department has been criticized in community meetings and at a state legislative policy hearing for what was called a lack of communication in the first several days after that Christmas Eve fire at the Clark and Coke Works. What's your response to people concerned that not enough was being done to keep them informed of what was happening, whether it was in the Mon Valley or in the county as a whole?
Well, as you know, we posted information on our website, but unfortunately, that doesn't get to everyone. I think these days it's challenging to figure out the best strategies to get the information out. We've certainly been doing our best since then to try to get out as much information as we possibly can. And we actually met with advocates, and they gave us some suggestions, which we followed. And that included things like sending information to schools, to physicians, to local authorities, going out to Claritin for a public meeting. We actually have been putting out information on a weekly basis in a report form in terms of new things that might be going on. And as you probably know, we've been putting out information daily on whether or not there have been any exceedances. So we have definitely tried to increase our communication strategies, but I think this is a challenge for health departments nationally in terms of how best to get information to the public on a whole variety of issues.
Did you get the sense, did you hear that we rely on you? You are, you know, basically in charge of the health of the county. Please let us know what's going on.
Well, we did, and I think.
But let's face it, people did not go to the website. They may not have even known to go to the website after that fire. Maybe they were expecting to hear it on the media, and the media didn't report on it for several days because we weren't really aware.
Right. So I think that you know, the old days of using the simple media of TV, radio, and newspapers seems to have changed dramatically. And I think the websites and Facebook pages are one strategy, but I think we just have to get better overall in terms of thinking about how best to get information out. I think local officials in our 130 municipalities can be very helpful getting information to them. They all have their own Facebook pages and social media strategies as well, I think can also be helpful. So I think this is really influencing how we're going to be doing our business going forward.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you is, you know, you're going to take those strategies to just better communicate with the public for whether it's an update on Clark and Coke Works or just some other issue confronting the county?
Exactly. I mean, you know, we've been having rabies cases. How do you get information to those communities to make sure that people are aware of what's going on there?
Okay. So let's get a status update of what is going on at the Clark and Coke Works. How are you in communication with U.S. Steel?
So U.S. Steel has been providing us with a report every week, which we have put online if people are interested in seeing that. And that's what we've been including in our weekly reports as well. They have predicted, I guess, that they're going to get about 70% of the plant back up and running in May. But as you also may know, there was an exceedance at the North Braddock monitor, and we are preparing an enforcement action relevant to that. We do speak to U.S. Steel if we have concerns about self-reporting of certain emissions and things like that we don't necessarily have the data on, and clarification of information that might be in the reports that they have provided to us.
Right. Some people have suggested, why not, especially with, you know, months later, and they still will not have it completely resolved until mid-May, and that's not even completely, that's 70%, as you said, why not order them to go to a hot idle?
Well, I think from our perspective, the challenge of the right enforcement action, which has to be methodically considered so that it stands up under any kind of legal duress, is critically important. So at this point in time, we are looking at our options.
You're looking at your legal options because of the challenge?
Enforcement options.
Enforcement options. Okay. So does that seem like an extraordinarily long? We're talking about at least 5 months before 70% is repaired. So at what point will you make a decision whether we need to take stronger action, including a possible hot idle?
Well, I would say fairly soon. At this point in time, however, we are monitoring, as you know, exceedances in multiple places on our monitors, and we have an additional monitor in Claritin and soon to be notifying the public that there's an additional monitor that will be monitored. The Irvin Works as well, where the flaring is taking place. We have not had any exceedances since the time that we actually issued our notice in Clareton itself, nor on the new monitor that has been there. But in terms of the additional emissions that are being flared, that's the area that we're focused on at this point in time.
U.S. Steel's five-year operating permit for the coke works expired nearly 2 years ago. The old permit is still in place. It's still functioning under the old permit. What's the process of they've been up for renewal? What's the process? Why has it not been renewed? What's the process?
So now that we have these compliance issues, both the big enforcement action that we took in 2018 and the issues that are going on now, all of those things have to be concluded before a permit can be issued. The company has to be in compliance to issue the permit.
The big actions, $1.6 million in fines, I believe.
Yes. And it's currently being appealed, as you know.
Still being appealed. So therefore, could more fines still be in the offing?
Well, at the end of this episode, as it's called, once they get back up and running, yes, there will definitely be an assessment for fines.
Okay. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Allegheny County Health Department Director Karen Hacker. What do you think will it take to improve the overall air quality in the county? The overall air quality, stricter enforcement, more fines on polluters, what?
So as you probably know, overall, the air quality in the county is actually improving. And we've had this one particular challenge, which is our Liberty monitor, that has not been trending in the direction that we want it to trend. And that one monitor is also how the compliance with the Clean Air Act is determined. We must get that monitor into compliance. And so all of the issues that we've been doing in terms of our civil penalty changes that have been made to increase the fines, in terms of the types of enforcement actions that we're taking, are really done to push that improvement much faster than it had been going. And then simultaneously, there's a number of things that we've now suggested that the state actually get involved in if they want to give us additional tools. We've made multiple recommendations to them that include things like, would industry slow down their work when we have a poor air day, poor dispersion, as it's called. We've talked about raising the level for fines. We've talked to them about changing the definitions of episodes, all of those types of things, many of which would have to be done at the state and even potentially the federal level.
So your hand in certain instances are tied or
well,
what you can do?
Well, I think the work that we've been doing over the last 3 years, we have really expanded our enforcement efforts and we're using a whole variety of tools that, as far as I know, remember I've only been here about 5 years, had not ever been used in the past, such as the recent enforcement action where we basically said, if you don't have improvements over the first two quarters, then we will put two of your worst performing batteries into hot idle.
All right. I have a question. As the top health official in this county, how do you feel about the proposed ethane cracker plant in Beaver County? I mean, it's not under your purview, but emissions do not know county borders either.
Well, obviously it is not in my purview. And at this point, I think the main concern that we always will have is, will the emissions from that plant affect our county? The recent modeling that we've done suggests that it would not affect our county, but
no?
Obviously no, because of the prevailing winds. However, modeling is one thing and reality is another. And so unfortunately, one of the things about regulators is we're usually in the position of having to wait, use the predictions, but then obviously wait to see what happens.
All right. So, I mean, we're still a little ways away for that. How closely can you? Will you be monitoring if those computer models are not accurate?
Well, we have a very strong monitoring system in our county. We have some of the strongest monitoring system that you can imagine
right.
in the country. And so I would assume that those monitors would show changes if, in fact, there were some issues that we were going to have to deal with. But again, we use the modeling. This is a DEP project, as you know. They're
right.
the overseer of that, and they've provided us with the data so that we could also do the monitoring for our county.
Okay. So if you say to the DEP, we're noticing an increase in emissions. Our monitors are picking this up. Can you just ask for something because you don't have the authority to actually do something for a plant that's in another county?
I don't know if I can really speak to what our options are should that kind of thing happen. If we began to see changes in the monitors and in the levels that we were seeing, I'm sure that those conversations would take place.
Okay. Moving from one health concern to another, Allegheny County began mandatory blood testing for lead in small children a little over a year ago, January of 18. Children are to be tested once between 9 and 12 months of age and again at age 2. According to the data on your website, more than 22,000 children were tested for blood lead in 2018, and 2.08% of those children tested positive for a concerning level of blood lead. So just how concerned should a parent be about that level? What is a concerning level?
The Centers for Disease Control has been following this and has now identified the level of 5 micrograms per deciliter as the level at which we consider to be lead exposure in the blood. So that's the level that we are currently using. And the number that you were talking about is, in fact, the number of children with a blood lead level that exceeds that level of 5 micrograms.
Right.
That level has changed over the years as we've learned a lot more about what lead can do to the developing brain in particular, and it has continued to drop. We need to do more and more to diminish as much of the lead exposure as possible. You should also remember, though, that lead is a naturally occurring element, so you can't get rid of it entirely. But there's a lot that we could be doing, particularly in old communities with aging infrastructure where lead is still present.
Yeah, I mean, lead in our water received a lot of attention, obviously, over the last few years. So how big of a factor are the other sources of lead, as you said, naturally occurring in our environment? We're talking about in our dirt, in our backyards, or wherever, and of course, old paint.
Right. Well, and most of the lead that we're worried about isn't naturally occurring. It's really part of legacy pollution, lead in soil in particular, both from demolition of houses that had lead paint, but also from issues of industry depositing lead and gasoline, which used to have lead in it as well. So that's in the soil. We still have a huge amount of lead paint in our homes because we have a lot of homes in our county that were built before lead was removed from paint, which was in the early 70s. And with that, obviously, we have lead in solder and lead in pipes. And so the combination, and then the other area that we often are finding is lead in things like jewelry, sometimes in various Ayurvedic remedies, for example, sometimes on toys from paint from other countries. So that's also a source that we have to be concerned about.
How are you getting the word out? I know you've been putting out some brochures in multiple languages to inform parents. Is that strictly about the danger of lead or to get their children tested?
It's both. And I would say we're not alone in this. There's a very large coalition that's currently under the leadership of Women for a Healthier Environment, and we're working with them. We've also contracted with a number of organizations in the communities where we have the highest burden of exposure to get the information out as much as possible. But I think there's still a lot of work we can do. It seems like a lot of folks forgot about lead. Mm-hmm. And the whole situation with Flint, I think, brought it right back into the visibility, which in the long run, I think, is a very positive thing because it gets us to reinvigorate our efforts in this matter.
There's been a lot of research about the negative impact of lead on developing children done right here in the Pittsburgh area about IQ, about learning ability, even behavior. Is there any way to limit the harmful effects after absorption, do we know?
Well, I think, first of all, you'd like to do the primary prevention, which is to get it out altogether. So efforts towards lead-free and lead-safe housing are starting to percolate, and we're seeing those across the country as well. And also, obviously, the work the PWSA is doing to get the pipes out and to actually replace them with non-lead pipes. I think the other thing, though, is that once exposure happens, you want it to be as short as possible. and you want to remove any other additional exposure. I would say that, you know, the other thing we have now available is that if a child has a lead level over 5, they can be referred to early intervention. And I wish more people would take advantage of that option as well. But I think it's also important to know that there's many other things that contribute to a child's development. And so we don't want to stigmatize children. And we really want families to recognize that the support structures and the learning environment are also very, very important.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Allegheny County Health Department Director Dr. Karen Hacker. Just a couple of minutes left. My colleague Sarah Bowden reported this morning, flu numbers and certainly flu-related deaths aren't nearly as bad this year. Do we know why?
Well, we think that this has to do somewhat with the coverage of the vaccine, which was reported recently to be about 50%, which is certainly better than it had been last year. But it also probably means that the vaccine coverage of that strain really helped the situation, and maybe the strain itself was not as lethal potentially as the strains in the prior years. But, you know, I wish we knew the answer to those questions because that would help us a lot in subsequent years.
A quick follow-up. What is coverage in the sense of the vaccine?
Basically, every year the CDC plans for the next year's various varieties of flu virus. And in doing so, they create the vaccine. And unfortunately, we don't actually know how good that vaccine is in quotes, covering that particular strain until we get it about halfway into the flu season.
So we've talked a lot about challenges this morning, especially those we hear about most from our listeners. What are you hearing from the community? What's concerning you in the county right now?
Well, I think, you know, air quality is definitely something that there's a lot of discussion about. But I would also add to that, we continue to have problems with opioids. Although this year, it looks like we will see a decrease in the number of people who've died. It is certainly not where it needs to be. We are still concerned about violence, and particularly the impact on African-American males. And then I could list a whole host of other things as well. And then, of course, tobacco, obesity, things like that, which remain chronic disease, which remain a major issue in our county.
Dr. Karen Hacker is the director of the Allegheny County Health Department. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
So ahead on The Confluence, civil unrest has eased in Haiti following deadly violence earlier this month. We'll visit with Bishop Leon Pomfil, who has maintained his longtime ties to Pittsburgh while leading 100 churches in his native country. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the rock band Kansas headlines a show in Pittsburgh for the first time in 1974. The performance at the Benedum Center, then the Stanley Theater, was significant because the crowds in the city were one of the first to embrace the band outside of their hometown. The scheduled headliner, Queen, had to cancel, prompting the show promoter to ask Kansas to expand their set. The group returned to Pittsburgh last October to celebrate their 40th anniversary, performing their entire album, Point of No Return, at Heinz Hall. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Civil unrest has eased in Haiti following deadly violence earlier this month that led to the U.S. State Department issuing a do not travel advisory and urging all non-emergency U.S. personnel and their families to leave the country. I sat down late last week with Bishop Leon Pomfil, who has served in Haiti for many years with the Church of God in Christ. He says mainland Americans often misjudge Haitian people and Haitian challenges.
Usually Haiti apparently comes to mean civil unrest and poverty, but Haiti means more than that. Haiti means is the first black independent country in the Western Hemisphere and in the world, and the second country after the United States to gain its independence. And so we're trying to widen the scope, even to change the country. And I believe the fight going on right now is still a struggle on two different groups that have a different view or vision for the country. It's a struggle for a better Haiti, although it's going through some through violence.
Right. For people who don't know, you sort of split your time between Pittsburgh and your congregations in Haiti, more than 100 churches, I believe.
Yes. I spent a month in Haiti, the whole month of January. In fact, it was a very meaningful month for us, because it was the celebration of the 90th anniversary of the presence of the Church of God in Christ in Haiti. Mm-hmm.
Congratulations.
So, thank you very much.
Since you returned to Pittsburgh, I believe February 8th or 9th, things have calmed down. But what are the feelings? What are the emotions that you have heard?
It's emotion of fear, because the streets have been controlled by protesters, for most part,
right,
and they prevent people from going out. So a lot of people were homebound. And my church in Port-au-Prince, my assistant pastor was not able to attend service the last two Sundays, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. According to NPR and other media outlets, the recent protests were fueled or at least sparked by a court report that alleges Haiti's government, including the president, diverted or misused billions of dollars in development money. Is that misuse of billions of dollars particularly troubling because of the challenge of poverty?
Yes, sir. This is a big issue right now in the country. And I think finding solution, at least an explanation of what took place, may take time and mm-hmm. also may continue to fuel the unrest in Haiti. Mm-hmm. The government of Venezuela has given Haitian the leeway, at least, to use funds mm-hmm. through the fuel that they send there. And of course, as loans for improvement.
As loans,
yes. Right. And it has been revealed that some $3 billion were not accounted for. So, of course, everybody wants to know what's happened to this money.
Right. Bishop, I wanted to ask you, for people who don't know, you spent half your life, maybe more than half your life, in the United States. I believe you came here to further education, and then you became a minister and served many people. Then you were appointed bishop for Haiti about 7-8 years ago?
Yes.
Okay. So do you feel that you've helped deepen the understanding and awareness by Pittsburghers about your home country, its people and culture during those years?
I have a positive view of Pittsburgh and my relationship with people here, because I came here 47 years ago, mm-hmm. and I spent most of my life here. Mm-hmm. And I believe that I've been well received, and I shared my fear, my doubts, and my problems about Haiti, and my desire to see change there. And I think a lot of people have heard my voice.
Bishop Leon Pamphile is the leader of the Church of God in Christ in Haiti. Thanks so much for coming in.
What a privilege it was to be here. And we hope our audience will continue to reach out to Haiti and to help the poor to improve their conditions.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
WYEP celebrates Black History Month with a musical reflection.
We shall overcome one day.
We Shall Overcome is an iconic song that came to be closely associated with the civil rights movement. Although its precise origins are disputed, it was adapted from a gospel song, and in the 1930s and 40s, it was used as a labor anthem.
We'll walk hand in hand someday.
In 1957, Pete Seeger, who had performed the song regularly, played it for Martin Luther King Jr., and soon it began being used in civil rights protests and marches. In the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, it was sung multiple times by different performers. The song became so important that Martin Luther King incorporated it into speeches.
We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome.
And it was even used by President Lyndon Johnson in a nationally televised joint session of Congress to decry violence against marchers from Selma to Montgomery in Alabama and to urge passage of what would become the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Really, it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
For more audio celebrating Black History Month, listen to WYEP throughout February or go to our website at WYEP.org/Black History Month.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. While building trails in Mount Washington's Emerald View Park several years ago, Nathaniel Broaddus noticed some of his fellow African-American colleagues working in the park but rarely using and enjoying its scenic trails. That realization led him to organize monthly blackpacking nature excursions. Broaddus tells 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort, the goal is to get more people acquainted with the mental and physical benefits of hiking.
One of the young men on my crew, he would show up to work 2 hours early sometimes, or he would stay 2 hours after work out on the trail that we were working on. So one day I had to ask him, I was like, you know, what are you doing here? We're not paying you for this. And he said, you know, it just makes me feel good to be out here. So I decided, you know, I want to see what that feels like. I'm a veteran. I know very much what PTSD feels like. I know very much what it feels like to be hypervigilant, to be angry. It was an awesome opportunity for me to go and see, like, all right, this makes him feel good. You know, maybe it can make me feel better, right? I went out the next day, and I hung out on the trail, and it was amazing. A few days later, I reached out to my good friend Shannon. Shannon talks a lot about mental health and the need for self-care. We framed the event that would become blackpacking. You know, what would it mean for us to get our friends together in this outdoor space and not have to worry about solving all the problems of the world, or not worry about having to fight against white supremacy and, you know, social injustices? What if we could just get together and talk about hiking?
Who do you encourage to come out and enjoy the outdoors and go on the trails and go hiking?
We want to encourage people to know that you don't have to be in great shape to come blackpacking. Our trails go all the way from, you know, 3/4 of a mile to, we've done 5-mile hikes. But we always encourage everybody to know that, number one, the human body is capable of amazing things. Long after you get tired, is your body still capable of going? Mm-hmm. Number two, we're not here to break anybody's back. You know, we want to get out and have fun. We want this thing to be relaxed. We want to be able to get to the end and say, man, I feel good, right? And still be able to eat and laugh and joke with each other. So, you know, that's what it's really all about, is making this as accessible for everybody as possible.
And which parks do you go hiking?
Oh, we try to get all around the city. We really started out with Emerald View Park on Mount Washington because that really does have a lot of meaning to me. We just hiked a beautiful trail in Hazelwood. My co-founder Shannon planned this hike and took us all out, and it was the most beautiful scenery you'll ever see. I had no idea that there were parts of Pittsburgh that looked like this. Oh my goodness. You know, that's what blackpacking is all about, is bringing us together in these spaces and creating, you know, that access.
How often do you go blackpacking?
We go once a month.
There's no charge?
No, blackpacking is completely free, and we're committed to keeping it completely free. The only thing that we ever ask of anybody is that if you come, that you consider bringing a food item to share with the group. Now, if you can't bring a food item, you should still come.
Nathaniel Broaddus of Blackpacking, thank you for taking time to do the interview.
Thank you, Elaine.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 6 months ago, a Pennsylvania grand jury report revealed the names of more than 300 priests accused of sexually abusing children in the Commonwealth. That helped bring about the summit on clergy abuse at the Vatican that wrapped up yesterday. It was watched closely by Catholics in Pennsylvania, as 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk reports.
Father Frank Almaid leads the service at St. John Fisher Parish. He's been a priest for 40 years. When Mass wraps up, he tells me he knew several of the clergy members named in the grand jury report.
So it hits me and hits my generation really hard.
In some parts of the world, bishops are skeptical that abuse happens in their diocese. Almaid says he hopes the summit will change that.
But it is an awareness at the highest level of our church and the heads of bishops' conferences around the world, that they go back to their areas, wherever they may be, and say, brothers and sisters, this is a real problem that we have to address.
At the summit, victims, laypeople, and church leaders railed against the church, hiding crimes and silencing victims. Almaid says it's not just their voices that might change minds.
It's probably the quiet conversations that are happening in the small groups around the table, in the coffee bars, and among the bishops and maybe others going out to dinner and talking about this.
Still, the summit left some Pittsburgh area Catholics like Ryan O'Connor wanting more action. O'Connor was 9 years old when he says his parish priest first abused him. He's 46 now, still a practicing Catholic. He shows me a crucifix, Jesus on a cross, hanging on the wall of his family's house.
Sometimes when you need a reminder, you look up and there he is, always knowing that he's got my back.
Even when the news coming out of the Vatican isn't all O'Connor hoped for, the summit ended with no concrete plan detailing the church's next steps.
Frankly, we've had enough of talk. We want action. We want true accountability.
One way, he says, would be for the church to support extending statutes of limitations for sexual abuse. It can take decades for abuse victims to come forward, if they ever do.
The perception of the church, I believe, will change greatly if they allow us to stand in front of our perpetrators and truly, truly take our lives back.
One young Pittsburgh Catholic says the church needs to identify and sanction clergy members involved in cover-ups. Here's 22-year-old Thomas Michael.
I think if this can ultimately lead up to like a really big investigation, I think that'll be phenomenal.
The summit focused largely on crimes against minors. Michael says it did not cover the entirety of the abuse problem. The Pope recently defrocked a former cardinal after accusations that he abused seminarians and young priests.
I was hoping they would talk more about that, because that seems to be like a big part of the sex abuse crisis. It's kind of this elephant in the room.
Meanwhile, Michael will continue to pray for the victims, for the perpetrators, and for Pope Francis to fix these problems. Amy Sisk, 90.5 WESA News.
And Amy Sisk joins us now in the studio to continue the discussion. Amy, you visited with several people over the weekend. Who did you speak with?
So I went to Mass Saturday evening at St. John Fisher Parish in Churchill, and then afterwards I spoke with the priest there, Father Frank Almaid. He's been a priest for 40 years. Then I also wanted to hear from a young Catholic, so I met up with Thomas Michael, who's a 22-year-old Carnegie Mellon University student, and then I also met with a survivor of clergy sex abuse, Ryan O'Connor. He told me he's actually a two-time survivor of sexual abuse, once when he was quite young by a babysitter and then again by his parish priest growing up.
What sort of expectations did Pittsburgh Catholics have going into this summit?
You know, I think expectations generally were kind of low. The Vatican itself said not to expect too much concrete action to come at the summit itself.
They even said deflated expectations.
Yes, they did. And, you know, the summit just ended with a speech from the Pope and no real concrete next steps.
All right. So there was a meeting with survivors prior to the summit. Right?
Yes, there was. And that's something that the Pope had encouraged. So it was 190 bishops and church leaders from around the world who came to this summit, and the Pope encouraged them to come and listen to survivors even before they got there.
And I believe you talked to Father Almaid of St. John Fisher Parish about meeting with survivors.
Meet with victims. Hear their stories. Cry with them. Hug them. Hear their anger. when you listen to victims, all of a sudden your attitude is not about structures, it's about hearts that have been broken.
And Father Almaid spoke with me about a time that he himself met with a victim of clergy sex abuse, and then he also went and spoke with that priest and said that that had a profound impact on him. And so that's what Pope Francis is urging clergy members and church leaders around the world to do.
Did you get a sense of the people you talked to, what they were hoping for, something maybe more concrete?
Yes, you know, you hear a lot of talk among victims and among advocates for a zero tolerance policy. So essentially a policy that if there are credible allegations against a priest, that person is removed from the clergy. Thomas Michael, the young Catholic who I spoke with, he had wanted to hear more about the issue of abuse in its entirety, because this summit focused largely on the abuse of minors and didn't really talk more about Theodore McCarrick was recently defrocked, right, among allegations that he had abused seminarians. So you wanted to hear more about that issue.
All right. And you alluded to a little bit earlier in our conversation, you spoke with Ryan O'Connor, a survivor of clergy sex abuse, who we heard in your piece earlier.
Wow. Why don't you call Vatican III to change your image? That would be the real action. That would be the ultimate step to fix the empty churches.
And very briefly, what wasn't addressed at this summit?
You know, like I said earlier, we didn't have a lot of concrete next steps. The Pope offered some guidelines that the church will address going forward, but he didn't really say exactly what the next steps are. So I think we'll have to wait and see what comes out of the Vatican.
WESA reporter Amy Sisk, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We have a couple minutes to spend with WESA's political team leader, and that is Chris Potter. Chris, a new development has happened regarding Amazon and a letter offered of support. When Pittsburgh finally got a peek at the package offered by the city, included tacit approval from Pittsburgh Public Schools, including a signature from board member Kevin Carter. Carter said he never signed the letter. An investigation just wrapped up. Chris, what's happened from that investigation?
Well, here's the big reveal. Inconclusive. It's not clear exactly who signed this letter on Kevin Carter's behalf. He is the school board member and is the head of the board's business committee. And as you say, when the Amazon proposal was released late last year, he said, hey, I never signed this letter. And he offered some on Facebook. He showed signatures of his versus the signature on this letter. They didn't look similar. So the school district did this investigation. He provided more than a dozen handwriting samples. But the handwriting expert said, hey, we don't have enough samples from right around the time he signed the letter. And he also didn't respond to questions about whether he was sick or injured in any way that would affect his signature. So we can't say for sure, although we think he didn't actually sign this. They have no idea who did.
Think. And inconclusive. So where do we go from here?
It's not at all clear. I mean, this report actually opened up some questions. One piece of news that was of interest to me and to Sarah Schneider, my colleague who did a lot of the reporting on this story, was a text from Ira Weiss, who's the district solicitor and was kind of the go-between in terms of furnishing this letter to city officials, and Mayor Bill Peduta's then chief of staff, Kevin Acklin. And Mr. Weiss said something like, Kevin's agreed to sign on PPS letterhead. Signed letter was then furnished to the city the next day. Mr. Carter's lawyer says he had no idea what he was talking about. So it really remains unclear, and it's not clear that there's any real interest in pursuing this any further.
And you can find Sarah Schneider's reporting on this topic at WESA.FM. So in just a few seconds, Chris, is this a final report? You said inconclusive. Is there another step?
It would have to take action by the board to continue to examine this. And although our reporting continues on this, we're not hearing a lot of enthusiasm for going another round on this thing.
Chris Potter is WESA's editor for government accountability and politics. Chris, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, President Trump holds his second summit with North Korea's leader. What realistically can be expected from that? a visit with former Assistant Secretary of State Rick Barton, plus the growing community in Pittsburgh of Ischial immigrants from Guatemala. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.